Hey, CE Plan members from CE Impact, this is Game Changers. I'm Jen Moulton, and with me today is our resident Game Changers contributor, Jeff Wall. Hey, Jeff.
Hello. How you doing?
Great. How are you?
Doing good.
Good, good. Back from spring break. Had a little break last week. So
yes, we did. It was nice. Yep, absolutely.
Yeah, it was nice to just unplug for a little bit. We soaked up some sun in Florida, which you never know if there's going to be sun in Florida. So,
yeah, better than you and I in Iowa, that's for sure. So
that's
yeah.
Right. That's right. Well, today I am actually super excited about this topic. I just wrote about this in Jed's desk. Actually, I just read the book, or recently, I guess last fall, the book Outlive by Peter Attia, who is a physician and is now in this, longevity space, as there are so many of, lots of podcasts, lots of Instagram influencers, all these people on longevity. We all want to live longer and more gracefully. So people are capitalizing on that. But he's a physician and does a lot in data and, really digs into the studies. And so I find it more interesting than some of the other ones that are a little bit surface. But I've been following his podcast and he talks a lot about rapamycin. So I was so excited to see that we are going to talk about that on our podcast today, too.
Oh yeah, no, I agree, and I, we talked about this before recording. I think part of the impetus was this is it, there's a groundswell of interest I think in using this, and then there was a huge article in the Washington Post about a week before this recording, and I think with that kind of media attention, I think physicians and pharmacists are undoubtedly going to get questions about this. Well, hey, do you think this is a good idea sort of thing?
Yeah.
And so I think, I think discussing it is a really good idea. So yeah. So
yeah, we can jump. I'm super interested in your take. So
I appreciate that. So yeah, we'll jump into it. One of the things that I've read other longevity experts talk about is that if you take a look at our pharmacopoeia at this point, basically our 50,000 foot view of developing drugs, it's usually been anti something, right? Somebody has disease, it's causing something, there's some molecular or receptor, site problem, and we're going to try and block that or stop that. So really kind of antibiotic, anti-hyperlipidemia, anti-hypertensive, anti-hyperglycemic. I mean, you can go on and on and on, but the vast majority of our pharmacotherapy is there's something wrong going on that leads to a disease state, and we're going to try and block what's wrong to basically ameliorate the disease state or slow its progression or whatever. There is very little on, are there medications we could give to patients before they develop chronic disease that would either prevent the development of chronic disease or significantly lessen its impact? And, there was a paper that came out a few years ago that suggested, and this was pre-COVID, and these numbers have probably been, I think, somewhat blunted by COVID, but, they estimated that, since the dawn of the 20th century, that the average Western European and American has gained 11 to 12 years lifespan. Right. So, we are living, 11 to 12 years longer than our ancestors did in the early 20th century. But unfortunately, those aren't good years, right? Those are in many patients, unfortunately, years where they just are living longer with more and more comorbid diseases. The comedian Dennis Leary talked about this. He kind of joked about, he had, at the time he was a heavy smoker, and he said one of the things that irritated him about people who told him about smoking is they said, well, smoking takes 10 years off your life. And his argument was those are the 10 worst years. They're the years where you're in pain and all this other stuff. So, I mean, he is being facetious, of course, but I think that's a real issue is that yes, our lifespans are increasing, but unfortunately our middle and early lifespans aren't increasing, right? So people aren't spending more time, without disease. They're spending more time with disease. They're alive, but with disease. So there's a lot of interest. And as Jen points out, there's the whole industry, maybe a good word of longevity medicine. In other words, what can we do to help extend the lifespan of people in young or middle age who largely don't have disease and prevent those diseases from occurring and allowing them to live a longer, healthy life without disease. And so again, there's been a lot of notice about this. And the one of the drugs that has been purported to do this has been the anti-rejection drug rapamycin. And rapamycin is kind of a backup drug, I think, to most solid organ transplant protocols. I mean, nowadays, you get a kidney transplant, liver transplant, you're going to get, tacrolimus and mycophenolate. Usually those, there's some variation there. With certain types of organ transplants, adding on drugs like rapamycin or sirolimus or everolimus is used just to help prevent the possible development of acute rejection, especially with organs that you basically can't afford to have fail, like the heart or the lung. So that's where the drug kind of came, is FDA approved and kind of looked at. But now there's this kind of groundswell from, as from physicians and unfortunately influencers on social media and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, saying, hey, this is a drug that, may in fact do what we're talking about. It may, if you take it before you have disease, you can have an extended lifespan where you're healthy, And so that's kind of the idea behind rapamycin. We'll explain why the thought that is here, kind of coming up here. Now, remember that the FDA, does not approve any drug for longevity, to my knowledge. And the only indication really for this medication is organ transplant. And so, basically there will probably never be a randomized controlled trial on this for two reasons. One, rapamycin's long been generic. And two, I don't even know how you design a study like that. I mean, would you literally just, randomize, 30-year-olds and who are healthy and give half of them rapamycin, half of them no, and then follow them for 10 years? I mean, I'm not sure that you could ever probably do a proper randomized controlled trial, because you'd literally have to have this trial going on for a decade plus. So we will probably never know with high level of certainty whether drugs like rapamycin do in fact extend lifespan. Now, shorter studies might be able to say, okay, well, look, we can't say for sure you're going to live longer compared to controls, but all these biomarkers and looking at muscle mass and all this other stuff may show that, hey, compared to normal aging, this does improve. But the problem is that we're probably not going to get some high level data on this. And so unfortunately, I think we do kind of fall into two camps here. You've got people like Jen was pointing out, who I think are really trying to take a data-driven approach to this and saying, okay, this is what the level of evidence shows in animals. This is what the level of evidence shows in humans. Let's take a look at the pros and cons. And then you've got kind of the celebrity doctor approach, the Dr. Oz-like approach of, hey, why not? Can't hurt you sort of stuff. And oh, by the way, I've got this on my website and et cetera, et cetera. So, I think that, those who are getting asked questions about this really should probably know what the latest data shows. There have been more and more physicians who are prescribing this as an anti-aging treatment. The Washington Post in their article note that they kind of did a review and found that there are multiple anti-aging or longevity health practitioners, prescribers who are prescribing rapamycin, and that probably thousands of patients across the United States are using it. And it's cheap, it's generic. So I mean, unlike a lot of the stuff we talk about, you can get it for about $10 a week. So I mean, it's actually fairly inexpensive. They actually interview a physician in the Washington Post article who says he's treated 1,500 patients with rapamycin since 2017, and he calls it the most important drug in the history of medicine. I'll be honest, whenever I hear stuff like that, I hear ducks quacking in the background, but that's just me. so, I think that that's obviously a way kind of semi-crazy take. But I think that we shouldn't let that kind of hyperbole basically keep us from taking a look at the evidence surrounding this. Now, this all stems from studies that were done in the early 2000s, particularly with mice, that found that mice who were given rapamycin, their lifespan was extended anywhere from 20% to 60%. And so mice who received rapamycin lived longer and importantly did not develop a lot of the disease associated with aging compared to their controls. And so, there are a number of those studies that kind of came out. Now, another person they interview in this Washington Post article, a physician named Elena Volpe, who's a longevity expert at the University of Texas, is they quote her as saying, mice might be a little bit different from humans when it comes to the drug. And I completely agree with that assessment that mice are not humans. I think that like all things, there's been the history of medicine is replete of stuff that looked really good in the lab, looked really good in animal studies, and then just never took off in humans because it either wasn't well tolerated or didn't do what it did in humans that it did in animals. So, I think taking the evidence that, okay, well, mice are mammals, humans are mammals. So if it increases the longevity of mice, it probably increases the longevity of humans, is a gigantic leap that I don't think is evidence-based and probably not the way to go. But that hasn't stopped several companies from trying to either figure this out or make money off it or both. For example, there's a company called Altos Labs, which is now looking at derivatives of rapamycin that might be more targeted and maybe safer, and will undoubtedly be more expensive. There's another company called the Hevolution Foundation that is pledging to spend $1 billion a year to look at drugs that are anti-aging. And again, a lot of these influencers and social media, you know, have amassed pretty large followings and are really, you know, promoting the benefits of rapamycin. So now, how rapamycin was discovered is kind of interesting. Like most anti-rejection drugs, it was completely serendipitous. Rapamycin was collected by a scientific expedition in the 1960s when they were examining the soil of Easter Island, which is not really what we should be calling it. We should be calling it Rapa Nui because that's what the natives call it. It's one of the most remote, inhabited places on Earth. And they looked at the soil and found that this drug basically, you know, not necessarily blocks the immune system. I mean, it does have some immunosuppressive properties, but it also seems to regulate the immune system. And so because of that, it was looked at in organ rejection and was approved clean back in 1999 for that. That's why it's generic now. And it's why it's relatively easy to get. There are numerous telehealth companies. There's one called Ageless RX that I'm sure you basically give them some money, they give you a 2-minute review and send a prescription of rapamycin to your local pharmacy. Not only is oral rapamycin being looked at, but the compounded topical is being looked at as an anti-aging skin cream. And again, it's worth noting that, again, there's not a lot of evidence that looks at whether topical rapamycin, in fact, does anything, right? How does it do this? Well, rapamycin is an inhibitor of mTOR, and mTOR is one of the major regulators of the aging process. So, you know, as we get older, all our cells start to develop senescence, where basically, you know, they start to die more rapidly. They start to show signs of stress and stop working like they should. And one of the big propagators of that is this cytokine called mTOR. And rapamycin and its derivatives, and there's several other rapamycin-like drugs out there, all block mTOR. So they block this major regulator of the aging process. And so, you know, that's kind of the theory. We've got some animal studies. So what do human studies look like? And that is the point of a systematic review. And we'll have a link to that and the Washington Post article in our show notes. That the systematic review was just published 2 years ago, where they aimed to basically take a look at the effects of rapamycin in humans. What has been studied up to this point in humans? As you might imagine, there are almost no randomized controlled trial data out there. So this is largely case series or retrospective controlled studies or things along those lines. There's been a couple of small RCTs, but on the whole, this is pretty poor data, to be honest with you, taking a look at rapamycin in a variety of disease states, trying to determine whether it has a benefit in aging in the immune system, the cardiovascular system, the pulmonary system, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that's what the result of this systematic review is. The introduction to the systematic review notes that the mTOR pathway has been linked to multiple chronic disease processes. It causes declined immune function. It causes deteriorating pulmonary function. It helps accelerate bone loss. It helps. It probably has some role in the loss of tumor necrosis factor cells and surveillance cells looking for cancer. So again, you're more likely to develop cancer as you age, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They also note, and they do quite a bit of talk about how it may have a lot to do with the loss of sight as we all age, basically. So in this study, again, it's a systematic review. So like most systematic reviews, they did a extensive review of PubMed, Embase, Scopus, the Cochrane database, et cetera, et cetera. And they basically just used the terms of all the rapamycin or rapamycin derivatives like rapamycin, sirolimus, everolimus, et cetera, et cetera. They wanted to look at patients who were over age 18. They wanted to look at outcomes that were either aging related physiological changes or on disease, and almost all of them were on disease, unfortunately. and that they were interventional studies with either rapamycin or its derivatives, basically. They did exclude, obviously, animal and in vitro other type studies. They looked at cancer or obviously organ rejections, because that's what it's approved for. And if the studies had fewer than five participants in the study, they were excluded. That's a good idea. I would probably not include those either, basically. So once that was done, they did what most systematic reviews do. The studies were then pulled. They then reviewed the studies. They used the standard Cochrane bias tool that takes a look at the level of bias in studies. They had two independent reviewers then go through all the studies, taking a look at that. And if there were conflicts, they had a third reviewer to kind of break the tie. As always, they look at things like the randomization process, the intervention, any missing outcome data. Again, that's pretty standard. When it was all said and done, they reviewed a ton of articles, but came up with 35 articles undergoing full screening and 19 articles included in this review. The vast majority of these, again, were either retrospective control studies or very small randomized control studies or essentially large case series. So, you know, again, not strong data. And they mentioned that in the systematic review several times. So 19 articles, 10 of them were in healthy individuals, 9 of them were in patients with aging-related diseases, and 6 of the 9 ones focused on neurodegenerative disorders, 1 on pulmonary disorders, and 2 on rheumatologic disorders. When you added it all up, they had only 401 patients in this 19 studies, of accumulation of 19 trials. So again, that tells you right there how small the number of patients in each trial was. Median age was 50 years, though the spread was incredibly wide, up to 85 years in some of these groups. And the cohort size ranged from 6 patients to 121 patients. So, you know, again, if even one study had 121 patients, that tells you, again, the 18 studies were just incredibly small, right? The vast majority of them used rapamycin, though there were a few studies that looked at everolimus and sirolimus, which, again, are derivatives of rapamycin, basically. The doses were literally all over the place, anywhere from 1 milligram a day orally to higher doses where they actually did therapeutic drug monitoring and targeted levels in kind of the 6 to 8 range, which is what we do when we're looking at organ rejection. So doses were all over the place. Trial periods were all over the place. Some of these studies literally gave 1 or 2 doses of the drug. Others looked at multiple week studies. So again, all over the place when it comes to dosing and duration and things along those lines. So keeping all that in mind, what do we kind of find when we take a look at the studies looking at neurologic stuff? And again, the vast majority of these were people who already had some sort of neurologic disease, and see if rapamycin was beneficial. And the bottom line was no. Rapamycin did not seem to improve neurologic disease in patients. And when they looked at one study that looked at rapamycin 1 milligram a day for 8 weeks in healthy individuals to see if it would affect cognitive dysfunction, and it had no benefit in cognitive dysfunction. So from a neurologic standpoint, at least with the poor evidence we have to date, it does not look like rapamycin either stabilizes, improves, or treats neurologic dysfunction, either in healthy individuals or individuals with disease. They did do in some of these studies, taking a look at MRIs to see if there was, you know, again, any difference in blood flow or nerve fiber thickness. And again, they didn't really find anything in those patients. They took a look at, apparently there's been several studies that have looked at vision changes, especially in patients with macular degeneration, and giving rapamycin, and actually found that there was a couple studies that did find that patients who already had macular degeneration, rapamycin may be beneficial. But they also found that in healthy patients who just have normal degeneration of eyesight with aging, that doses of rapamycin may actually lead to retinal thinning, which is not a good thing. So maybe a benefit in patients with existing, especially a diabetic macular or retinopathy problems, but not in patients with essentially just normal decline of vision with health. In the world of pulmonary medicine, patients with pulmonary hypertension, low doses of everolimus did statistically significantly increase baseline measurements of cardiac output and lung function, and actually found that patients had increased ability to exercise and things like that. Now, of course, pulmonary hypertension has some inflammatory components, so it's certainly possible that just its anti-inflammatory effects may be the reason why. But for whatever reason, it seems with pulmonary hypertension, rapamycin may have a benefit. Again, all in small studies. They looked at the endocrine effects of rapamycin pretty significantly. Unlike the calcineurin inhibitors, these drugs do not seem to increase blood sugars. One of the big problems with tacrolimus and cyclosporine is that they very commonly increase blood sugars. The mTOR inhibitors don't do that. And so there's some thought that maybe they would actually delay the progression of diabetes or prevent the development of diabetes. And the data here is a little bit more mixed. Some studies did show that it caused patients who were kind of pre-diabetic or were healthy, that it actually allowed them to use insulin more efficiently, that uptake of insulin into tissues was better in patients who are on rapamycin. But again, those were poorly done studies with either one or two doses. So again, hard to extrapolate that. But when they took a look at patients who had diabetes, rapamycin did not seem to have a significant effect on plasma concentration of fasting glucose, random glucose, or hemoglobin A1C, unfortunately. So while it may have some small effect in kind of poorly done studies in healthy patients to perhaps have them use insulin more efficiently, it does not seem that in patients who are pre-diabetic or diabetic that rapamycin currently has data to support its use in treating diabetes. Probably one of the things they studied that their mTOR inhibitors seem to have the best data in, again, unsurprisingly, is rheumatoid arthritis. There's been several 12-week studies that have looked at either everolimus or sirolimus with rheumatoid arthritis and have found that, yeah, it improved symptoms, decreased joint swelling, decreased markers of inflammation. Again, not surprising knowing it's an anti-inflammatory drug. Unfortunately, in those studies, they also found an increase in total cholesterol, LDL cholesterol, and triglycerides. So that may not be a very good thing as well. And then they looked at muscle development. There's several small studies that have looked at healthy individuals and have put them on, several weeks of mTOR inhibitors to see if it improves exercise tolerance or muscle development. And it seemed to have, at least in these studies, no real effect. So it didn't seem to improve exercise tolerance. When they looked at muscle development markers, it didn't seem to improve either. Also, there was a small study looking at physical function in just healthy individuals aged 70 to 95. And this, if we're really kind of trying to take a look at the use in elders to see if it would actually work as an anti-aging agent, they unfortunately found in this study, well, at 1 milligram a day orally for 8 weeks, that there was no significant increase in exercise, walking speed, grip strength, muscles, anything along those lines. So unfortunately, in this small study, they actually did not see a benefit in older healthy patients to actually, improve, I would say, quality of life sort of stuff or aging issues and stuff like that. The other thing they looked at pretty significantly was the immune response to vaccines. And this is probably one of the areas where these drugs have been studied the best. Again, while these drugs are probably, described as anti-inflammatory, a better way, some of these longevity experts are talking about the drug is that it's an immune regulator. So it isn't necessarily an anti-inflammatory or pro-inflammatory drug. It basically helps regulate the immune system so that the body can make a response to foreign invaders like, bacteria, viruses, stuff like that, but can regulate the immune system so that there isn't a pro-inflammatory spike with a lot of pro-inflammatory diseases. So when we take a look at the immune response to vaccines, there's actually pretty good data on this. There's now been several fairly decent randomized control trials, mostly with everolimus, that have found that if you take these drugs around the time that you receive vaccines, you see a significantly higher spike in antibody titers, especially with influenza, and that's probably the one that's been studied the most. Even in patients who are relatively older, who usually don't have a very good response because of as we get older, our immune system just doesn't work as well. They actually found that even in older patients, they saw a significant increase in antibody titers, again, particularly to influenza, in patients who received rapamycin around the same time that they received the vaccine. So that's kind of interesting, I think, certainly. Again, not something I'm probably going to recommend routinely, but it is interesting and may give us a clue to kind of what we can use these these medications for. Now, rapamycin is an anti-rejection agent. So it does have, again, some issues when it comes to infection and things like that. And so, you know, I think the other piece that we have to kind of really seriously consider is the safety of these medications. And the systematic review, I think, does a really good job of taking a look at safety and saying, okay, you know, what did they find in these 19 studies? In general, surprisingly, they found that there were very few significantly serious side effects with the mTOR inhibitors, and that they were almost always reversible upon discontinuation of treatment. And really, the big side effect they found with most patients was canker, mouth sores that were difficult to heal. And that's actually long been known as a big side effect of the mTOR inhibitor. So that's not particularly surprising. However, they do note that in the study that looked at rheumatoid arthritis, that they found that there was a higher number of patients who had serious infections. And in fact, they had two deaths due to septic shock in the rapamycin group compared to the placebo group in rheumatoid arthritis. So, again, I think it's worth noting that these drugs do have the potential to be immunosuppressive and probably do increase the risk of infection. Now, the low doses that a lot of the longevity experts are recommending, which is largely 1 milligram a day, you know, is probably for the purposes of organ rejection, subtherapeutic in most patients. So I think what a lot of longevity experts are arguing is that at these low doses, you're still going to get the effect on the cells of mTOR inhibition, but you're not going to get to the level of immunosuppression that would increase the risk of serious infection. I think that remains to be seen. And I do think that it's something that, you know, if your patients are asking you about this, that's something you really need to think about, especially if they are at risk of having other infections. So if you had a diabetic, or if you had a patient who had other, you know, issues associated with immune response, I'd be a little nervous about recommending it just based on safety, to say nothing of efficacy. And I think that the mouth ulcers are going to be the other thing you're probably going to want to warn your patients about. So the authors of the systematic review, basically, you know, their summary was that if you take a look at some very, very poor studies, there are signals that the drugs may improve some immune responses and may improve some pulmonary responses and may have, you know, some small effects in some other disease states. But at this point, it does not seem to improve neurologic function, endocrine function, muscular function. And the one study that tried to take a look at just basically giving it to older, healthy patients did not seem to find a benefit in quality of life, muscle strength, things along those lines. So the evidence to date has not been very strong. Now, again, that it doesn't answer the central question. If I take rapamycin when I'm 45 years old and I'm relatively healthy, will that add on to my healthy lifespan? Again, I'm not sure how we're ever going to really figure that out, based on the difficulty of doing studies on that. So, I mean, you know, does a systematic review answer the question that I think a lot of longevity experts are arguing that, you know, that taking this drug when you're younger and healthy will prevent the development of disease? We don't know. But I think that the evidence, you know, in humans does suggest that there are some improvements in several people who already have disease. But one could argue that a lot of that is just due to its anti-inflammatory effect, and that it in and of itself probably doesn't in those patients improve the healthy cells, if you will, that are going on in patients, basically. So, you know, they note that safety was better than I think they expected, that in these small studies, they did not find a significant increase in infections, though, again, they point out that there was that rheumatoid arthritis study and that most people tolerated the drug pretty decently. So as far as the studies themselves, they note that the very, very small sample sizes, that they, you know, were kind of poorly conducted studies, the doses were all over the place, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And they also noted that the one study that showed an increase in lipids was pretty concerning as well. So they kind of walk away from the study suggesting that the data right now to suggest that rapamycin either, you know, improves longevity in healthy patients or helps, you know, blunt or stop age-related diseases is pretty minimal. And they also note that don't know the right dose. We don't know how long et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a ton of questions and not very much answers. So, what do you as a prescriber or pharmacist, when a patient inevitably comes to you and says, "Hey, I saw in the Washington Post there's this paper that, that they're using this drug to make people live longer, and I'm 45 and I work out and I'm real healthy and I, want to live as long as I can and I want to be healthy. I think I should take this drug." What do you tell them? Well, I think that the bulk of the evidence in humans right now does not support its use in just extending healthy life in humans. Again, acknowledging that we're probably never going to get strong data in that it does seem to improve health in animals, particularly mammals that have been studied. But as was pointed out earlier, mice are not men or humans, and so it I think that you take a big leap when you make that assumption. It is cheap. It seems to be fairly well tolerated. But I again, I'm not really sure if you were to start somebody on rapamycin, how you could prove that it in fact is improving, is keeping them youthful or keeping them healthy as they go on. So, in the end, I probably would not recommend that based on the evidence that we have now. If some of these rapamycin derivatives come out that are being studied, and I'm sure will be much, much more expensive if they were to find that, that might be something else. But I at this point, I would be hard pressed to recommend this drug based essentially on animal data. But I think you're going to run into patients, and I think a lot of the patients that come to you with this are going to be, "Well, I studied on the internet, or I follow this guy, on Instagram or whatever that, says that it works really good, and he's a doctor and he's a longevity guy and blah, 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 blah." I think that, those are the people who are often going to come to you, and that if you don't prescribe it, and I'm not saying you should prescribe it, they're probably going to get it from somebody else anyway. And so I think that if that's the case, then if you're like, "Well, if you are going to do this, then here's what I want you to watch out for." And I think the two big things are again, mouth ulcers, development infection, stopping the drug if you start to develop a serious infection with a fever, I think is a good idea. For the pharmacists out there, like many of these medications, there are some drug interactions, and we could have probably done an entire podcast just on that. So again, watching closely for drug interactions and people on medications is going to be important. So I think the role of most prescribers who aren't going to be interested in prescribing this medication based on the evidence for longevity are going to have to deal with these patients on these medications from another source. And what we know need to know about safety and drug interactions is going to be pretty important. So that's kind of where we're at, Jen. What do you think?
Yeah, well, super interesting. And I think to your last point, just making sure that people tell you if they're on it from somewhere
Right.
else so that you can, identify those drug interactions. We're always on the search for the, magic bullet.
Yeah, the fountain of youth.
We want to take something and live forever. I think the other one, the other drug that has had some longevity discussions is metformin. And there is a little bit more evidence about that. So I wondered if you could just briefly touch on that as
And
well.
that's, yeah, absolutely. And metformin, I mean, again, I'm not suggesting that, everybody and their dogs are taking metformin, but I think that, yeah, there is some pretty good evidence both in animals and a little bit in humans, again, about just general anti-aging properties and some of the things, but primarily in patients who are starting to develop the metabolic syndrome, right? So people who are starting to, their blood sugars are starting to creep up, their LDL is starting to creep up, their blood pressure is starting to creep up, which again happens to many, if not most, especially Americans as we get older, that there are some randomized controlled trials that are relatively well done that actually go out 6 months or a year that shows that metformin can seem to help stabilize or even reverse the beginnings of the metabolic syndrome in these patients. So while again, I'm not sure I started taking metformin when I was 20 years old, I think if you're 40, 50, 55, 60, and you're seeing your family medicine doc or your internist, then they're like, "Yeah, gee, your hemoglobin A1C is 6.2. We got to watch that." Or, "Gee, your blood pressure is starting to creep up," or, "Wow, your LDL is starting to get a little bit higher." I mean, again, definitely use the medications that are indicated for that. But there is some evidence suggesting, again, especially in that kind of young to middle age. At my age, I'm starting to think that there's young middle age and middle middle age and then high middle
Absolutely. It
age.
gets younger and younger
Yeah,
every
you
day.
know, exactly. The old, you know, like almost all healthcare professionals, the older you get, you see a patient, you're like, that's not that old, you know.
Yeah,
You know,
right.
you know, yeah, no, that, you know, they're not that old, you know. But in any event, yeah, I think metformin is something to consider in patients, particularly as you know, they kind of reach that, you know, middle age, young middle age sort of thing, 40s, 50s, where they, you know, are starting to see the development of the metabolic syndrome. Now, of course, you know, a lot of that's related to obesity, so obviously they should do, you know, health style, lifestyle changes, try and get their, you know, their diet under better control, try and get their weight under better control, certainly. But yes, I think there's some evidence there. I have no doubt that somebody somewhere in patients in their 40s and 50s is going to do a study with the GLP-1 drugs.
Yeah.
You know, about this, because why not? I
Right.
mean, we use GLP-1 drugs now for everything else, so, you know, why
Yeah, we'll
wouldn't it
start to
do
put it in the
that? So
water.
yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, I think one of those things you could argue is that, you know, and I think there's evidence that suggests this too, is that, you know, there is kind of a Goldilocks area of weight for most humans, that, you know, you don't want to be too thin either, right? I mean, that, you know,
Right.
that being too thin, you know, as associated with its own issues, right? And so, I mean, I think, you know, kind of being, you know, ha having kind of an, you know, a BMI in actually the high end of normal is what I've read is, you know, so if you're, you know, the normal BMI is kind of 18 to 25, if you can run a BMI in the 23, 24, 25 range, that seems to be the sweet spot as far as the development of disease that they've seen so far, that, you know, there actually is a spike in other diseases as your weight goes down too much, right? So there's kind of this Goldilocks, you know, the target that so far is really what we should be trying to do. And so I think, yeah, who knows, will they end up, you know, using GLP-1 drugs to kind of target this, you know, high normal BMI, and will that, you know, will that end up having some benefit in longevity and healthy longevity as time goes on? It'll be very interesting to see. So.
Yeah, well, we're all looking for the easy road, and we know it's not the
Yeah.
easy road. I mean, a lot of what, Dr. Atiyah talks about in that book is, actually doing the hard work for
Right.
longevity. So, and I'm guilty of it too, so no judgment here, but I think those are the questions that we ask patients is how, and the fact that it is inexpensive,
Right.
is probably going to lead a lot of people to it. I mean,
Right.
the we're seeing obviously GLP-1s are not inexpensive for
No.
people who insurance doesn't pay for it, and they're still doing it. So,
Yeah.
whether that cost is a barrier or not, but with rapamycin, it's not because it
Right.
is so inexpensive. So I
Yeah.
think we're going to start to see it a lot. So I think it's important just to know what the risks are. And thanks for doing a great job of that.
No, no problem.
All right. So fun topic this week. That's it for this week. So if you're a CE plan member, be sure to claim your CE credit for this episode by logging in at ceimpact.com. And as always, have a great week and keep learning. We'll talk to you soon, Jeff. Thanks.
Thank you.